Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So what does it take to make a local council authority a space for change making? Councils and local authorities are best known for taking care of the basics, like picking up the garbage. But what would it mean if those very practical jobs were done in a way that strengthened how our communities work? Today's Changemaker Chat is with Nick Kimbar. Nick describes himself as a bureaucrat. But how he does his job defies the typical stereotype of a disinterested paper shuffler. Instead, he is the Director of Strategy and Design at the London Borough of Camden in central London. Nick has played a critical role in developing a community-led local authority, involving community leaders so they can help shape the decisions of council, and creating a relationship of kindness and respect with the community in all the services that the local authority provides. Nick talked to us about what it means to work for a relational local authority and how that practically changes what they do every day, such as how they run things like child protection. He explains the power of this place-based mission and shares the kind of hope that can come from true relationships with people, and what that can then inspire and shape in other places across the United Kingdom and beyond. So, let's go. I'm Amanda Tattersall. Welcome to Changemaker Chats, conversations with people changing the world. Changemakers also produces episodes that are feature stories about social change campaigns. Changemaker UK episodes are supported by the Civic Power Fund and work with the University College London Policy Lab. They bring together extraordinary ideas and everyday experience to understand how we can change the world. Check them out at ucl.ac.uk/policy-lab and civicpower.org.uk. We are broadcast on Acast as part of the Iconoclast Network, so you can find us there as well as on all the usual podcast apps. You can find out more about Changemakers on our website, where you can also sign up to our email list. It's changemakerspodcast.org. Nick, welcome to Changemaker Chats.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It is our pleasure to have you, our first special voice from the UK on Changemaker Chats for this season. So we're doubly delighted to have you here. And look, my first question to you is to orient our awesome listeners to your work. Can you describe to us what kind of changemaker are you?
Yeah, sure. I guess I'm a bureaucrat. People have different understandings of what that word means, I guess. But for me, it has positive connotations. But what it means is that I help run a public institution, a democratic organisation, one that spends about £1 billion of public money every year. So it educates people, it houses people, it builds parts of the city, it helps shape the way the city grows, it manages conflict within that city, how people move around it and how they use it. And I guess so I work inside what is essentially a legacy institution, you know, an 18th, 19th century legacy institution, which is trying to adapt to the huge shifts in society that are going on all around us. So I guess I'm someone who thinks a lot about place and how you solve problems in place in a context. So working for and with communities, I'm very passionate about local government and its role in the UK, its role around the world, really. I work in a system in the UK which is hugely centralised as well, which might be useful context for listeners. So there are no constitutional protections for local government in the UK. the sort of condescension of the centre is quite sort of palpable. But I am absolutely kind of a localist. And I work in an organisation, I guess, which is has a stated mission around making a transition from bureaucratic, that word again, from bureaucratic to relational. So trying to shift that legacy organisation to one where everything, process, system, policy is about relationships with the community, between staff. That anchors everything. And I guess my purpose and the purpose of the people that I work with is about that transition. That's what we're kind of here to do. And that's the change that I guess I'm trying to make in my daily life. And trying to use the example of, you know, my little corner of North Central London to try and change the world. Camden talks about itself sometimes as a sort of shining city on top of a hill. It's got an obligation to do things and to talk about them and help build alliances with others, which means that the shift that you can make in that tiny little corner of one city somewhere in the world can add up to something quite profound and global, I guess.
Yeah, I apologize for laughing. I guess I was just picturing a Yes Minister episode of The Bureaucrat as opposed to the prefiguring a relational landscape bureaucrat, which is who you are and what we're going to talk to you about today. But before we go into the quite extraordinary work that you do with Camden Council and what you have been able to accomplish by bringing a relational approach to this legacy organisation, like this old organisation, transforming it from what some think of as a bureaucratic organisation to a relational one, I want to understand about why you are this kind of person, like why you have sought out to work in this part of the world. So please, for our listeners, for me, would you go back in your own story, you know, go back as far as you think as it makes sense, and I guess share with us what were some of the key moments in your own journey that have led you towards this path of working and as you do now with Camden?
Sure. I mean, I guess how I got here, I mean, it's always an accident, isn't it? But you kind of look back for the patterns afterwards, and I think there are some. So, I mean, I guess my first experience of public services, having some sort of interaction with them, was in my sort of early teens, I guess, where we had an experience, quite deep experience of unemployment in the family. So my father was unemployed for a number of years in the early 90s. We almost lost our home. We were in the benefit system. So I claimed free school meals. So I had to, you know, toddle off every day to an administrative office and pick up this yellow ticket, which meant that I could get free school in the queue. I suppose quite a deep experience of insecurity at a formative time in my life. So I've had an experience of public institutions that have nourished me. Like the school environment that I was in was a nourishing one, and it has set me up for my life, for my career. But in that same institution, in that same building, I was doing this walk of shame to pick up that yellow ticket. So I guess it's created some sort of affinity with public services, some sense of when they work well and when they don't work well, and when they do all of those things all at the same time, I guess. So imperfect, but inhabited by people who care, I guess. And then when I fell into local government, because it was just an accident, I mean, I wasn't a 14-year-old boy who was passionate about place and local government.
But you understood their value from a young age that not necessarily everyone does. So even if you call it an accident, you could sort of see how it could create an attraction, right?
Yeah, it felt where people who cared about the world worked, and I needed to find somewhere to work, and that felt like a place. So I came into local government through the Local Government Association's graduate scheme. I started at a London local authority called Greenwich, and it was a scheme where you went and interviewed for different councils before making a choice. You spent 2 years there. You had rotational placement going around different departments, and you did an academic qualification as well. So I had a degree of choice about where I went, but Greenwich, the presentation that we received was at the beginning of what was a day-long assessment centre, was with this guy called Leon Yohai, who was the Assistant Director for Change Management, which was a quite amusing title. But Leon had been a director for housing management before that. He was a working class boy, Jewish, grew up on the estates of Woolwich in Greenwich. He used to be a stand-up comedian, but, you know, Marx.
Wow.
He was like one of the most charismatic people that I've ever met. And he's a very close friend now. But he was someone who he talked really passionately about those estates that he'd grown up on. He talked about the good and the bad, and he talked about all of those things in relation to his purpose, which was to rebuild them, make them places which provided dignity for working class people. And he had worked in that organisation, Greenwich Council, for almost all of his professional life, and had that same sense of optimism about what public services could and should be, but also challenge when they weren't quite right. So Liam would talk about producer focus of the housing department. He would be really challenging about some of the behaviours that he saw that he knew weren't right. So he was someone that I had like an immediate affinity to, and really was that kind of key mentor in the early part of my career. And then I left Greenwich, I came to Camden, and then there were lots of Leons. I mean, not quite Leon.
Oh, wow. lots of stand-up comedian Jewish guys who grew up on the state. Wow, that's amazing.
not quite all that, but I mean, people who were led by purpose, people who felt the same feels, I guess. And
you tell us, like, you know, you could have. I'm guessing, Nick, you seem like quite a capable guy. You could have gone to any council. What was it? I mean, sure, there were lots of Leons, lots of sort of people who had sort of experience of the council, were running in the council, like lots sort of passion running through the veins of the apparatus. But what else was it about Camden that made you say, yes, you know, I need to be in this place?
I mean, it was kind of in the bones of the organisation. I think sometimes when we talk at the corporate induction, when you know, new staff come, we take them all through this 2-day program, and a few colleagues from the senior management team come and talk. And I always tell the story about my interview process at Camden when I first joined. To prepare for it, I read what was then the borough and the corporate plan document called Camden, the Camden Plan. And it had this commitment to end child poverty. So I read this knowing that the council had neither the money nor the policy levers to end child poverty. But the resonance with me of that commitment at a values level was the thing that, you know, propelled towards this organisation, that it believed these things were right and proper to do, that it wasn't a ridiculous thing to state them as the policy of the council. And when I interviewed for my current job 2 or 3 years ago, one of the questions that they ask inevitably is the motivation question, kind of why Camden, why this job in Camden? And I sort of found myself talking a little bit about the language that the organisation uses. So, and it does use words like love and empathy and kindness. Those are kind of anchoring words for that relational approach. So I talked about the sort of lexicon of Camden being different to other places I've either worked in or known well. They use words like value for money and efficiency, and Camden uses all of those words, but it understands the relationship between them, that you, to manage your budget, to do the hard things, that there's not a opposition between those things. The leader at Camden, Georgia, she talks really passionately about relationalism, often to a group of quite sceptical people within the sector who aren't particularly comfortable with words like love or kindness or empathy being used. But she can talk about how that practice is fundamental to our approach to early help, fundamental to our approach to child protection, and also how we, very unusually in local government and London local government balance our budgets. So those budgets overspend because they're demand-led, they're quite volatile. Our finance people will tell you that we save £90 million a year compared to, you know, the base case, because our model is based on those things, because it is empowering, because it's building capabilities within individuals, within families, within communities. So I suppose that's my journey into Camden. That's why I've landed here. That's why I'm passionate about it, its model. And what its model can teach others, I suppose.
It's so extraordinary. I want to be in you know, council that loves, you know. I mean, how amazing is this? I can't wait to get into this. But, I mean, what you're describing is love as a practice, love as a verb, love as a motivation and orientation between the local authority to the people and the people to each other, like creating this environment which is, you know, where people see themselves as dependent on each other, that no one has all the answers, that people have to work together. I love that it's about love. I think that that's as straight and direct as it could be. Thank you. And bless that. So look, let's get into this question about local authorities, because, you know, obviously not me, right? But some might suggest that our local authorities are a little bit dull, you know, like the garbage, the dog poo, you know, these are the issues that local authorities deal with. Tell us, why have you chosen to work there? What is so important about a local authority?
I guess they're always in the background of people's lives. Sometimes they're in the foreground of people's lives in moments of transition, you know, from childhood to adulthood, in times of insecurity. They are a safety net. I think they're enormously consequential organisations, you know, from child protection to their role in cohesion and creating bridges between communities, to the essential services, the mundane things, which are kind of the lifeblood of everyday life in a city. They're also, I suppose, if you think about them in an historical context, they are organisations which built the public infrastructure on which the prosperity of the 20th century depended. You know, places like Birmingham and Manchester were engines of economic growth and social progress, and really the central state kind of caught up and consolidated. So I think they'll be consequential in that next big shift as well. They're places of motion, I guess, where it feels like everything is kind of in stasis, and the politics and central governments struggle to act. Local authorities, cities, their agility, I think, is essential and really important. So I think they're enormously exciting places to work in and for. I also think that, to your point about kind of dog poo, the dog poo is really important. So I think to be...
Yeah, if it's not picked up, it's really important.
It's a hygiene factor. It's a basic, but the progressive, innovative things that a city can do rely on getting the basics right. And there isn't and shouldn't be an opposition between those things. They are incredibly important things in people's everyday lives. So, yeah, that's what I think. I think they're great places to be and great places to be.
Yeah. And if the stuff that's in our immediate everyday experience when we walk out of our home, whether if it works or it doesn't work, it shapes how we, the very fabric of our lives. So I guess I'm interested in you painting, like we're going to talk a lot about what's happening in Camden in a sense of a local authority as it should be or as it could be. But I guess there's going to be plenty of our listeners who might not be 100% clear about the sort of world as it is, like what your average local, like what is a contrast between a typical local authority, like one that possibly is more a bit rigid and bureaucratic compared to what the kind of practice that is happening in Camden. Could you give us a slightly straw man argument, but, you know, a picture of what people would not off, you know, frequent experience might be in the world as it is when it comes to local authorities compared to what you're trying to create in the sort of world as it could be in Camden?
I think probably the easiest way of describing it is some local authorities will see themselves as deliverers of a set of services rather than working deeply with and alongside their communities, whatever those communities need, regardless of whether there's a statutory obligation, a budget to deliver those things. So an example kind of I might give from my own experiences around employment support services. So not a statutory obligation in UK local government, but Camden has invested quite heavily in a service called Good Work Camden, which sort of embodies that approach around relational practice. It's tried very deliberately to move the wider system around employment support, which is funded and managed by central government, by the Department for Work and Pensions, and is quite transactional. It's a sort of retail model, supports people into work, but any work, does that with a fairly traditional set of tools, is quite heavily anchored in a system of kind of compulsion and obligation, which can include, at its most extreme, withdrawing people's benefits for not complying with certain work search obligations. Camden has invested like around that system, in an approach which is neighbourhood-based, goes to where people are, draws very heavily from that relational approach which I've described, which is has its sort of origins in children's social work. Those models come from a particular place. They're not widespread in the culture of how you deliver services. So we've tried to import that approach into the way that you support an individual with their work search. So it's fundamentally about engagement rather than obligation, building a bond of trust between the person and the person who's trying to help them. And that is the thing that you manage around. So when I managed these services, the thing that was important to me, the data that I needed to manage that service successfully, wasn't really about when people moved into work or the outputs which you might traditionally understand to support that journey into work. It was about the quality of the relationship between the job coach and that person. Did they have a relationship? Could you measure that relationship? The conversations that you had, which were giving an account of the service, were about that relationship, which gave you the confidence that that's the thing that would create positive outcomes. And positive outcomes, which you can't predict in a linear way. They can look very different for different people. And though, although you want to pay attention to whether people are moving into work, whether they're sustaining in that work, the most important thing from a kind of managerial perspective was the quality of the relationship, the reflection on practice, so that you had a system which was about the individuals, staff, and the person that you're trying to help, and how you're learning. So that, I think, is that's quite different from a local authority who sees its role largely to fulfill a set of obligations which are set from central government.
What has just, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to lift it up because that is so different from, I mean, central government in the UK. In every country that I've seen where there's where people are wanting to count outputs, did they get a job, as opposed to inputs, what is the quality of the relationship that is producing the outputs? You know, people go, oh, we can't measure that. But you're actually saying that you can. And actually when you do, the whole focus of the organisation and the kind of care that it creates shifts from, you know, often from this sort of penalizing sort of culture where we'll take away their benefits if they don't do this, you know, this sort of acting on people, acting to people rather than with people. But when we shift to the relational, the with orientation, that everything else seems to change.
Yeah, absolutely. But you, it's not either or. You can and should be doing both, I think. And The challenge and the kind of secret sauce, I guess, is around like leadership and culture. So you have a balanced set of metrics, some of which will be the traditional ones. But what do you pay attention to? What questions are you asking at different tiers of your organization across your system? That's the thing that's quite fundamental. And that is much more difficult to prescribe. That is about culture, fundamentally, purpose. And leadership is the thing that brings all of that together and means that you can pay attention to the right thing. You're incentivized to pay attention to the right thing. I don't think it's ever about choosing one approach over the other. It's it's the balance across those things.
Oh, isn't that interesting? So you're telling us there's not a silver bullet to being able to create strong and loving communities. Like, I think that's also, I mean, isn't that part of the richness in a sense that there is no single solution, there is no single measure, there's actually a multiplicity of practices and different ways of working that seem to be, the answer is lots of answers.
The answer is lots of answers and being able to hold a number of different contradictory things in your head at the same time and reconcile them. The art of kind of leadership and leading in this way. So if you look at practice that I've described in children's services, you know, child protection is the most fundamental thing a local authority does. Ultimately, the state can take someone's child away. It's our sort of primary obligation. That practice exists in an environment which is highly risky and highly regulated. So Ofsted, the inspector, you know, it's a high stakes inspection and accountability system. You can't have an approach which lacks like grip. So everything that I've described is not wishy-washy, nice language, soft. It's high support, high challenge. It's operationally incredibly robust. So I think that is a really good example of, in a system which carries a huge amount of risk, you can have this type of orientation. And that's what makes that system, firstly, safe, and secondly, one which can be about building human capability rather than just managing risk.
Mm. Yeah, because in a more carceral system, the only risk that's being managed is the risk on the state. Whereas I guess when Camden is seeing risk, it's seeing that there could also that a bad behaviour by the authority could also cause ongoing harm in the community, and we need to see this from all the different directions. And that doesn't mean being light; it means just acting with a sort of a wider lens, a wider perspective on the situation, I guess. So you've mentioned this question of leadership, and I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the qualities of leadership and the elements of leadership in the authority that I guess set up this for success, right? Like, it sounds amazing, right, that you're able to hold these tensions in an example like child protection, but also I'm sure in other relationships that the council runs as well. How is that brought alive? Like, I'm sure it's not just because you've got a nice set of values on the wall. Like, how are those values enacted and scaffolded throughout the practice of the authority?
So I guess the level of ambition and the unity between the sort of political ambition and the managerial ambition. So, you know, we have really strong alignment between the officers, the officials that work in the organisation, and the elected members who set policy and make decisions. So a strength of kind of identity and purpose between that group is really fundamental. It's by no means a given in a local authority, and I think can be kind of deeply problematic where it doesn't exist. I think the strength of kind of narrative and storytelling and how that helps people express a shared purpose is really important. So we've had a consistent purpose in, you know, encoded in our strategic plan. So I think you're right about you know, values on the wall, but the story that you tell about yourself and the consistency of that over time, I think, is something which is really important.
What you tell us, what is that story? What is the story you tell about yourself?
Well, I suppose the story about purpose, which was in that document that I read in 2012 and is in the documents that I've been involved in writing ever since, is about reducing inequality and ensuring no one is left behind and that everyone has a voice. So it's an organisation which thinks quite deeply about social justice. It's an organisation that thinks quite deeply about how it shares power, when it can share power, that citizens are involved in shaping and directing services on a day-to-day basis, kind of operational and a strategic level. That story has been consistent over the 10 years that I have work for Camden. I guess the other thing that's important around like narrative and storytelling is like the gap. Are you doing what you say? And I think that is the thing that if that isn't close together, you feel very quickly in an organization. And that's a challenging thing to manage when you are having to work in like the first horizon of change. You're having to reduce your budget, you're having to make like difficult decisions that sometimes feel like nonsensical when you set them against your values. So the reconciliation of all of that and the ability to work in that first horizon, do difficult things, but also have your North Star, which is sort of deeply aspirational and quite kind of radical, and demonstrably do things in between those spaces, which allow you to get from point A to point B is absolutely fundamental.
Yeah. So you speak, I mean, the power of speaking to that North Star, I guess, keeps you, is a form of accountability. You know, like a perpetual accountability to being the council, being the authority that you say you want to be, and giving people in a space where there's lots of citizens' participation, giving people the space to hold you to account to that.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the point about accountability is sort of well made. And like, what's your sort of your leadership and accountability like rhythms, given how complex it is to like demonstrate impact and progress, and how challenging that is when some of the intellectual tools that you're drawing on, some of the metrics that you focus on, can lead you in the wrong direction. Like real accountability is around giving an account, like in all its richness, which you can't do necessarily through a set of data. So one of the kind of innovations in our current planning cycle, I guess, is this annual process called State of the Borough, which is an annual conference where we bring together citizens, partners, council staff. All of it is, I suppose, basically anchored in a report that we produce, which gives that account across the different domains of our strategic plan, says how we're doing, what challenges have come up in the previous year, what things are we kind of stuck on, and has a conversation with the community and partners about those things. And that's a much richer way of holding yourself to account, I think, than the traditional ways that bureaucratic organizations do those things, which tend to be 19th century devices, that sort of Victorian arcania of committees and formal reports, all of which are, I think, are important and we do as well. So it's not kind of either or, but it's a deeper conversation and a much more transparent way of holding yourself to account, and a much more generative process, because the trust that it creates leads to possibility, to collaboration, I think.
And also, you know, the other way that people hold borrowers to account is through elections. And, you know, you're not, obviously that people have that too, right? But this idea of a sort of collective imagination of citizens, whether, you mean, Camden does lots of citizens' assemblies and other forms of participation, even with that account, that accounting process, having a space that's with citizens in addition to voting, that's a sort of a form of dialogue and debate and so forth. It seems to be another advance on that question of, it's not just a stick. It's not just we'll elect another bunch, but a deeper conversation about how their community is going to work.
Yeah, absolutely. And how you manage change and how you manage trade-offs. I mean, our work around deliberation, we think, is kind of sector leading, and it's sort of evolved over time from citizens' assemblies, which were about agenda setting, so direction of travel around a particular policy area or problem that needs to be solved, to ones which are around trade-offs. So we've done one recently about the nighttime economy in Camden, and conflict between how people want to use the city, between residents and businesses. So how do you find a way between those things? The traditional ways of doing that are quite kind of potentially adversarial, whereas something which creates a space for for dialogue and collective choice, I think, is a really interesting and important device for local authorities, for cities, for communities to kind of engage in. We've done some brilliant work also around things like data. So a deliberative approach, bringing together a sort of citizens panel to talk about how the council treats citizen data, the potential applications of that when you think about the potential and the risks of automation and machine learning. But having that dialogue directly with citizens, creating a baseline of kind of trust, which means that you can then start to think about the applications of those things in a way that which you couldn't possibly unless you'd established that trust. So I think that's not something that you achieve simply and straightforwardly through representative democracy or the normal ways in which an English local authority makes decisions about things. That's not something that you do through the committee system. That is a different way of acting. It allows you to be a lot more agile, a lot more responsive to the social contract and the way that it's changing.
It speaks to that idea of a humble government, you know, the idea that the government needs to work with others in order to be able to create the answers, you know, those trade-offs that you're describing. It's if someone came in and just declared it, everyone would probably be a bit pissed off. But if the community who are affected negotiate out those changes, there's a chance to being able to find a solution that no one individual could have perceived from the, you know, for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think most problems can only be solved on the ground. And the mistake that governments make, national and local, is to assume a level of knowledge and agency that they don't really have. So we've done a bit of work in thinking with an organisation called Demos Helsinki, and they work quite closely with an academic at Columbia University called Charles Sable on that concept of humble governance, which is fundamentally about, you know, an important strategic role for national governments in setting a direction, a sort of broad framework goal, but then the responsibility becoming about how you deepen the consensus around that goal, how you experiment and how you learn in a structured and robust way. And that learning is then folded back up into how you set strategy and that kind of national level discussion. And I think local government is quite good at that. So I think central government is less good at that. But I think there are ways in which those two things can be brought together in quite a kind of powerful way. It kind of speaks to the question about scale. How do you scale this type of work, I think, is a really important question.
Well, it is indeed. It was going to be the question I was going to ask, right? Like this question of, you know, ending child poverty, for instance, is big and bold. You're in a specific local authority. You know, it's very local, right? How does such intensely local work scale? In what way, in what form can work in a single borough in London have an impact more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the hardest question. I think actually some historical parallels are quite instructive. So, I mean, in the UK, people talk about the Beveridge settlement, you know, profoundly important, but people also talk about it with a degree of kind of nostalgia. I mean, it's quite literally a narrative about, you know, a guy who...
and for those overseas listeners, who created the welfare state, right? Like that's the narrative is of the development of the welfare state. Good on him. Nice story.
But actually, it was an aggregation of many things and many different intellectual currents and many different like types of experiment, some of which were by local authorities, some of which were by friendly societies and trade unions. So there's a way in which you could see what that culminated in as being the result of the agility and experimentation of many different actors. So my argument would be around sort of embracing that experimentalist turn, really. And if you think about it from a local government perspective, you've got 300 or so local authorities in a position to experiment in small ways and in big. And the scale question then can be addressed through how you learn. So that's happening all the time, that process of learning and experimentation, but it's not happening with intent and structure to it. But you could, with coherent national strategy, we want to achieve these big things. These are the grand challenges that we want to solve as a national community. And these are the things that we need to learn. And therefore, we will incentivize places to do that learning at great pace. And one of the roles of an active state is then to share that learning, to adapt the things that only national government can adapt as a result of it, whether it's the regulatory framework, whether it's funding flows, and then building a capability at local level to do that learning. Because Camden is a relatively well-resourced place, it does the work that I've described and feels that obligation to like show its homework, see if others can learn from it too. But it chooses to do that. It's not necessarily incentivized to like evaluate and produce evidence that is used by others and doesn't necessarily have a clear audience and channel for that evidence when it does create it. So I think a national system which brought all of those things together and harnessed the kind of bottom-up problem-solving potential of local authorities, of places within sectors, could be something that is a kind of quite profound and energizing approach to government, and a bit different to what we have now.
Yeah, yeah. So the knowledge and the energy is from the builds from the ground up, a politics from the ground up, a sort of transformation from the ground up, and the idea of experimenting. Oh, it sounds fantastic. Look, this has been an extraordinary conversation with you, Nick. You know, you're a bureaucrat who loves. I love it. Is there, before we go, is there one thing across this extraordinary journey of relational work that you think that has really stuck with you as something that has fed your passion, your energy, your capacity to do this work?
I guess the thing that I've learned from it most is it's largely about kind of emotional labor, the tenacity that's required if you are a change maker in an organization or in a community at this point in time is extraordinary. So like almost the core skill set to some degree is around like how you look after yourself, how you emotionally self-regulate, all of those sorts of skills, capabilities are the things that you kind of really need to hold on to. So that's probably the thing that I've taken from all of this. Change is hard, and it's largely around like how you manage yourself, how you look after yourself, how you look after others.
It's like change yourself to change the world. I think that's a fantastic lesson, especially for a life of change making. Nick, thank you so much for coming on and sharing the story of Camden with us. It's been an absolute pleasure to have this conversation.
Thanks so much. Cheers.
Changemakers is hosted by me, Amanda Tattersall. Remember to subscribe to this podcast to catch all of our episodes. This is Series 8, so there's plenty to be inspired by in our back catalogue. Changemakers audio producer is Jules Walkerell. We are broadcast on Acast and are part of the Iconoclast Network. Changemakers UK episodes are supported by the Civic Power Fund and work with the University College London Policy Lab. They bring together extraordinary ideas and everyday experience to understand how we can change the world. Check them out at ucl.ac.uk/policy-lab and civicpower.org.uk. Like us on Facebook, Instagram and Threads at Changemakers Podcast. We are occasionally on Twitter/X at Changemakers99, and I'm there at Amanda Tatz, and check out changemakerspodcast.org for transcripts and updates on all of our stories.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.